Blog Talk Radio.
Damage. It's
2011 report by Earth Open Source asserts that glyphosate has caused birth defects in laboratory animals. So should humans really be eating fruits and vegetables that genetically contain this pesticide?
In addition to unwanted vegetation, glyphosate, say, inhibits growth and development of
mycorrhizal fungi.
Yeah, the microbe that fixes nitrogen in the soil and makes it available to plants. So this soil is now tainted for years.
Glyphosate has
also been linked to genetic damage, cancer, and negative reproductive effects like miscarriage and reduced sperm count. The latest solution is to genetically modify crops to resist the weed killer, 2,4-D, which has exponentially more toxicity to mammals than Roundup. Initially formulated for weed control in 1947, is comprised of 50% of the ingredients in Agent Orange, infamous for a massive destructiveness in Vietnam. For now, it seems as though nature herself is pulling in the reins, just as Roundup-resistant superweeds rapidly boomed into major problem over the past 10 years. The new super insect may be just getting started. Now that is sickening, man. You know, isn't that sickening?
I just think Mother Nature is wonderful.
No, not Mother Nature. I'm talking about
Monsanto. They're a wicked, wicked company.
God.
Wicked.
That's just sick, man. This is curious to me. As wildfires rage across Texas, Fed State Control and Scuttle volunteer firefighters. Now, I read that, and I was going to read that today but there's another follow-up to that, which questions how bad is the drought in Texas really, okay? Let's go to this one first. It really pissed me off when I read this.
This is from Natural News, too.
Yeah. As fires rage across central Texas for the past 3 days, local citizens sprang into action to protect their lives and property. Local churches opened their doors and began hosting refugees left homeless by the fire, which have now destroyed more than 1,000 homes and 100,000 acres across the state in just the past week. Several branches of the YMCA have been hosting families with children in a public school in Bastrop County, open its doors to serve an emergency relief. But hundreds of firefighters from all the surrounding counties worked today, 2 days and nights, in a heroic effort to contain fires. But high winds Sunday night and all day Monday thwarted their efforts, so the call went out for more volunteer firefighters to join the effort from across the state. Well, before they arrived, however, the federal government showed up and claimed it was in charge of the situation. Agents with the Federal National Interagency Fire Center, a coalition of federal agencies, including the U.S. Forest Service, assumed command of firefighting effort Tuesday afternoon, reports the Gonzales Canon.
It's a newspaper.
Yeah, so is it. Canon, Gonzales Canon. And the realnewsreporter.com is now reporting that volunteer firefighters who had, in some cases, driven all night to reach Bastrop County were turned away by the feds, who claimed that since local officials never made a formal request for volunteers, the volunteers could not be activated. So while Bastrop County burns from 40-plus fires that are still raging, the federal government is actually telling volunteer firefighters to go home.
What a stupid bunch of people.
Freaking FEMA all over again, you know? You want to read the rest of it?
Yeah, we were at the station getting set up into a strike team. And this guy came up and said that the U.S. Forest Service had assumed control over the situation. And that if you don't have a vehicle that squirts water, go home, said Gordon Gear. Gordon reportedly drove all Monday night to arrive in Bastrop and take part in the firefighting effort. You've got guys who had even driven all night long from Corpus Christi and Brownsville on their own dime. And they turned them away, he said. The same story reports that Jennifer Jones of the U.S. National Interagency Incident Center confirmed multiple federal agencies would be taking over the scene. Tuesday afternoon, the Bastrop County Office of Emergency Management stated on its Facebook page that volunteer firefighters would have to be activated by the National Forest Service first. In other words, if you're a local Texan and you want to help other Texans save their ranches or their homes or their businesses, you need permission from the federal bureaucracy first. How stupid. But some Texans aren't allowing the efforts to be thwarted. As Real News reporters says in its story, a group of Texas Nationalist Movement members are also certified firefighters and are in the Bastrop area and aiding civilian relief efforts with or without permission from Washington, D.C.
You probably start arresting these guys for helping out.
On the good news side, FEMA has reportedly approved several government grants to pay for firefighting efforts, although it should be mentioned that if the federal government wasn't taking so much of everybody's money to begin with, local groups of people could more easily afford to pay for their own firefighting defense and wouldn't need grants to cover the costs in the first place. FEMA has promised to cover up to 75% of approved firefighting costs. Even Governor Rick Perry alluded to the frustration of getting federal grants approved for relief efforts, saying it's more difficult than it should be to get those assets freed up from the federal government. Perry did confirm that Texas would seek federal disaster relief and the state officials were considering seeking military resources from Fort Hood. I found it odd yesterday to personally witness what looked like the U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopters taking off and landing near Tahitian Village fires in Bastrop. Does the U.S. military have constitutional authority to take part in firefighting operations on U.S. soil? Clearly, some military transport planes could be very useful right now, but we always have to be careful how much control we hand over to the military in these domestic situations. Never forget posse comitatus. Also, this is just confirmed. Governor Perry has activated Texas Task Force, billed as an elite search and rescue team, to head Bastrop County and make sure everyone is accounted for.
So, the rest goes on. So it goes on and on. But I'd suggest you might want to check out. There's two more articles by Natural News that I wanted to cover tonight. And one is near and dear to my heart because it involves gluten intolerance and celiac disease. I have a gluten intolerance, and I know many other people do as well. It's a very, very large and growing problem. Celiac disease and gluten intolerance testing, accurate or misleading? Jane G. made an appointment to see me after being diagnosed with Hashimoto's thyroiditis, an autoimmune disease of the thyroid which links to celiac disease, and suffering from years of gastrointestinal issues. I reviewed Jane's medical history and found that not only does she have
Hashimoto's and GI complaints, but she also suffers with inflammation in her joints and anemia, low iron.
Suspecting that gluten intolerance was at the root of all these conditions, I suggested Jane adopt a gluten-free diet. Immediately, I encountered resistance to this suggestion. Jane comes from an Italian-American family, and she lived for a good Italian food. In order to even begin attempting life without pasta and pizza, Jane really needed concrete medical evidence. I recommended that she undergo a new test from Cyrix Labs for gluten reactivity, complete with comprehensive autoimmunity profile. Unfortunately, this test costs $369 and is not normally covered by insurance. And Jane told me she could not afford that test or the appointment with a doctor outside her network. Instead, she made an appointment to get a celiac panel blood test done by her in-network physician. When Jane's results came back negative, her physician told her that she did not need to follow a gluten-free diet. She was relieved and excited, but she also told me she knew something was still wrong because of her ongoing gastrointestinal symptoms. I convinced her to go gluten-free for 2 weeks and see if she felt any relief. By the end of the first week, her gastrointestinal symptoms had gone away, and her question to me then became, "Do I have gluten sensitivity? Was the test a false negative, and what should I do?" Well, the most common blood test requested by doctors is a celiac panel. This test measures both your immune system's response to gluten and whether there is a damage to the intestinal tissue. Celiac consists of tests for the following, and I am not even going to go into all of this stuff, but have a rolling and controlling the immune system, anti-endometrial antibodies, or IgA, anti-tissue transglutaminase antibodies, and so on and so forth. According to Dr. Thomas O'Brien, this test records a false negative 7 out of 10 times. And these false negatives are due in part to the physician's interpretation as well as the patient's condition at the time of the test. Physicians may interpret the test as negative if the test for intestinal tissue damage is negative. Even if the blood test results indicate a positive immune reaction, the intestinal tissue test will only come back positive if there is severe damage or atrophy to this tissue, the kind found in an end-stage celiac disease. If there is only partial atrophy, the accuracy of this test goes down to 27 to 30%. And another issue with the celiac panel test is that it does not account for those with AGI deficiency, which occurs 10 to 15 times more commonly among people with celiac disease than the general population. All right? And patients with AGI deficiency...
IGA
will lack IgA antibodies. So this blood panel shows up negative. In addition, this panel only screens for one problematic portion of the gluten protein, alpha-gliadin, when there are approximately 60 problematic portions. If you have an intolerance to one of the 50-plus proteins in gluten besides alpha-gliadin, this test will also come back as negative. Dr. Vicki Peterson, author of The Gluten Effect, perceives physicians are misdiagnosing 50% of the population according to these false negatives. As we are learning, there is a spectrum of gluten intolerance from slight to severe, and these tests do not pick up anyone's insensitivities or sensitivities.
Dr. Alessio Fasano, MD, Medical Director of the Center for Celiac Research at the University of Maryland, does recommend that patients get blood tests for celiac disease, however. If these tests are negative, Dr. Fasano recommends getting tested for traditional IgE mediated allergy to wheat. If that test is also negative, he asks his patients to try a gluten-free diet for a period of 2 to 4 weeks to see if their symptoms abate. If they do, Dr. Fasano considers this low-tech de facto positive result the best test of gluten sensitivity available today. Dr. Fasano recently completed a research study that demonstrated gluten sensitivity without the presence of celiac disease does exist. The research confirmed that gluten sensitivity is different from celiac disease at both the molecular level and in the immune system's response. Fasano and his co-authors have demonstrated that gluten sensitivity and celiac disease are part of the same spectrum of gluten-related disorders. Imagine gluten ingestion on a spectrum, said Dr. Fasano. At one end, you have people with celiac disease who cannot tolerate one crumb of gluten in their diet. At the other end, you have the lucky people who can eat pizza, beer, pasta, and cookies and have no ill effects whatsoever. In the middle, there is the murky area of gluten reaction, including gluten sensitivity. That is where you are looking for answers about how to best diagnose and treat this recently identified group of gluten-sensitive individuals. There's a genetic component, apparently. As an autoimmune disease, celiac disease is a consequence of the interplay between genes and the environment. Two genes, HLA-DQ2 and HLA-DQ8, are absolutely necessary to develop celiac disease. Since 1/3 of the general population have one of these genes, the presence of DQ2 or DQ8 does not by itself mean that the person will develop celiac disease. Rather, they have the genetic predisposition for celiac disease. Dr. Kenneth Fine's research at Entero Lab shows that there are several more genes linked to the possible development of celiac disease, gluten sensitivity, and other gluten-related conditions. Other ways to test for celiac disease and gluten sensitivity include stool tests and salivary tests. These tests can be ordered online and performed at home without a doctor ordering the test. Entero Lab's unique test screens for gluten sensitivity, as well as for many other antigenic food sensitivities. Entero Lab's methods use stool rather than blood as a testing substrate because the immunologic reaction to gluten proteins occur in the intestinal tract and not in the blood. Entero Lab's salivary test also identifies the presence of genes associated with celiac disease and gluten sensitivity. All you have to do is swab the inside of your cheek and send it in.
Now, there's another one. It was a small intestine biopsy. A test or not to test, let your body be your guide. In testing for gluten sensitivity helps you feel confident that you are doing the right thing. Overlooking additional health problems, then test away. However, if going gluten-free makes you feel better, then don't worry about your test results. The slightest sensitivity to gluten can cause many health problems, and the only definitive way to rid yourself of them is to stop eating gluten. If you think you might be gluten sensitive, but you're not sure, there is a useful questionnaire at Health Now Medical that can help you get started. Also, visit the Gluten Free Girl for a complete list of safe and forbidden foods, plus a list of medications and health problems associated with gluten sensitivity. Now, I have to just, personal note, the way I found out I had gluten was that I was developing a psoriasis,
mm-hmm.
All right? And I found out that that psoriasis and most skin conditions are food-related, okay, are food allergies. So when the way I found out also was that I was drinking beer, and I found myself getting having this stuff come out as a psoriasis. I stopped drinking beer for a week, and my psoriasis left. And so, and then I found out found out about the gluten aspect, and that wheat today is almost all genetically modified. And because of that, I mean, I never had a problem that I knew of. Maybe I had a sensitivity to it, but I never had a problem up until about 4 years ago. And when I discovered that almost all wheat products today in the United States are genetically modified.
Use genetically modified wheat.
Right, and including beer and everything, and hops and olive grains, and they are for the gluten the sum of gluten in those in genetically modified wheat is four times above the organic or normal wheat. All right. And so for many people who are developing this sensitivity today, it's because of their eating genetically modified food. And they've gained a tremendous intolerance to gluten. And, of course, this celiac disease, which has developed and is something new because it's not being diagnosed properly. And, most people, if you have a lot of indigestion, heartburn and so on. You look into it because, or do it yourself. Just stop eating wheat products for a week and see what happens. I bet you'll be amazed. What's the matter?
I was just looking. They have an article on something that I'm interested in.
Hyperthyroidism.
And iodine plus. Mm.
Those are products, I think.
Mm. So there's all kinds of things. I just noticed that on the Health Ranger.
Right.
And he talks about things on this site.
And there's one more that he had. This is a follow-up one from what we read a week or so ago about Gibson guitar.
How they were raided and
they
confiscated
rated,
all of the guitars.
Right. And but it turns out that this is a short article.
As a follow-up to our report about the U.S. government's recent illegal raid of Gibson Guitars Corporation, a major U.S.-based manufacturer of musical instruments, Gibson CEO Henry Jerkowitz has openly announced that the U.S. government actually advised him in a pleading that if he was simply to move his workforce to Madagascar, he could avoid his current quandary entirely. See, he employs Americans.
Right.
This shocking written admission by government agents, which was expounded upon by Jerkowitz himself during a recent interview on KMJ AM's The Chris Daniels Show, clearly illustrates what the federal government is up to these days. By targeting a U.S.-based company with a U.S.-based labor force, which is an amazing in today's globalized world, by the way, for no legitimate or legal reason, it is obvious that an ulterior motive is at work. Mr. Jerkowitz Did an agent of the U.S. government suggest to you that your problem would go away if you used Madagascar labor instead of American labor? Daniel is quoted as asking Jerkowitz in a recent Red State report. After responding that the suggestion was indeed made into a written pleading, Jerkowitz confirmed insinuations by the government that if Gibson would simply outsource its labor force, Jerkowitz's problems would go away. Ironically, Gibson's first encounter with federal agents back in 2009 specifically involved rare wood imported from Madagascar, none of which was actually confirmed illegal. A ruling was also never made in that case, and Gibson was never convicted of committing any crime. And now officials are instructing the company to move its workforce to the very same country that is an unexplained problem for the U.S. government. So what exactly is going on here? Why is the government repeatedly attacking Gibson on baseless charges and now instructing it to actually eliminate American jobs by exporting them to Africa? The only logical explanation for all this madness in the light of the facts is a sinister plot to target Americans' few remaining large manufacturers for extinction and drive what few jobs remain to developing countries.
It's just sick. It's just really sick, you know. And in fact, it's so sick that I am going to share this particular article if I can.
On Facebook?
Yeah.
I think that's a good idea. People should know that's
really
what's happening.
Can you
publish that on Facebook?
Yeah.
They changed their format. I just think it's amazing that they target an American company, all American company, and would want the end, told him his problems will go away, just export your job to Africa, just relocate.
What an incredible jerk. I mean, you know, just unbelievable.
Is that what they do to all businesses? Is that why they're all over in India or China or Madagascar?
Probably
is that what
because
they do?
They're pressuring American companies to go there, you know, to destroy the American economy. This is what they're doing. This is the initial, you know, bullshit that's going on. That's why nobody has any jobs, plans. Because the American people, once they discover them by these politicians, they'll have a total revolution. This is an interesting one, too. Cancer breakthrough. Scientists discover harmless bacteria in soil kills cancer tumors.
Ooh, what a wonderful thing.
Yeah. Cancer remains one of the most feared diseases on the planet, and cancer patients being treated by mainstream medicine are usually bombarded with radiation and subjected to toxic chemotherapy that destroys healthy cells and weakens the body while trying to kill tumors. Thankfully, as Natural News readers are aware, a growing body of research is revealing that many natural substances have cancer prevention
treatment potential.
Yeah, including Mediterranean-type foods that fight prostate cancer, and walnuts, which contain breast cancer preventative phytochemicals.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's evidence a cure of cancer may be all around us and is as common as dirt. In fact, it's something in dirt.
Mm-hmm.
Researchers Alexandra Kubliak just presented the startling discovery at the Society for General Microbiology Autumn Conference, currently underway at the University of York in the UK. She and other members of her research team on the University of Nottingham and University of Maastricht have found that a strain of harmless bacteria that is widespread in soil is actually deadly, not to people, but to cancerous tumors. And the researchers have developed a therapy using Clostridium sporogenes, a bacterium common in dirt. They found that when spores of the bacteria are injected into cancer patients, they only grow in solid tumors instead of cancer.
Inside,
the cancerous growth. The bacteria produce a specific enzyme that activates a cancer drug. The result, unlike current chemotherapy, the natural bacteria treatment causes only the cancer cells to be destroyed, while healthy cells are left unharmed.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Callistridia are an ancient group of bacteria that evolved on the planet before it had an oxygen-rich atmosphere, and so they thrive in low oxygen conditions. When Callistridia spores are injected into a cancer patient, they will only grow in oxygen-depleted environments, i.e. the center of solid tumors. This is a totally natural phenomenon, which requires no fundamental alterations and is exquisitely specific. Head researcher Professor Nigel Minton said in a statement to the media, "We can exploit this specificity to kill tumor cells, but leave healthy tissues unscathed." And he added that the new discovery could lead to a simple and safe procedure for curing a wide range of solid tumors. This therapy will kill all types of tumor cells. The treatment is superior to a surgical procedure, especially for patients at high risk or with difficult tumor locations. We anticipate that the strain we have developed will be used in a clinical trial in 2013, led by Jan Thees and Philip Labin of the University of Maastricht in the Netherlands. A successful outcome could lead to its adoption as a frontline therapy for treating solid tumors.
Wow.
That's
isn't
exciting.
That
yeah, isn't that exciting? Yeah, that's great. That's really great. That's exciting. Okay. Okay, that's enough of that. I'm going to go back to...
We have to play that audio that you were thinking about. It's up there.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, folks. I think it's getting right to it. There's another one there. That one's kind of whacked. I'm going to go to another one. Hang on one second.
I thought you put audio on the Facebook.
No, I didn't have it there. Collapse closer as politicians. Yeah, this is another one. Eurozone done. Collapse closer as politicians bargain. Looks like the Eurozone may be dead.
Why don't you just play that? What's the next one here?
NATO uses Libya to match, surpass, and supplant UN. Okay, we can go to that one. There's one other that I wanted to see here. Okay. Let me play this one. This is from Russian TV, and it says how NATO. There's been a lot of news lately on how NATO is in Libya. About the problems that arise there.
Let's listen to what
they have to say. This is the Russian ambassador to NATO on the situation around Libya. So let's see what they get to say.
To discuss the situation in Libya, we're now joined by Dmitry Rogozin, Russia's ambassador to NATO, joining us live from Brussels. Mr. Rogozin, now NATO is saying it has no plans to finish its operations in Libya, in the foreseeable future at least, citing there's still danger to civilians. How legitimate do you think that claim is?
I think we have to be very careful with regard to what official NATO representatives say today, because the statements about tens of thousands of bombs and other ammunition being dropped on Libya, that they had no adverse effects on the civilians, that's what NATO has been claiming. That is very hard to believe. So that defines that we should be careful with regard to official statements from Brussels.
Several different reports have suggested that there were, in fact, British special forces instructing the rebels during the battle for Tripoli. Boots on the ground already. Those are despite promises to the contrary. Like you're saying, you can't always believe what NATO says. But why is that, and why do so many people believe what NATO says?
Слушайте, это типичная ситуация.
Well, it's typical when certain countries that are NATO member states are waging a war, interfering into a civil war into a country far away from NATO's sphere of control. Nowadays we can say that France and Britain and Americans are deeply involved in the conflict, but NATO as an organization is not involved officially. Well, that is a typical military propaganda scheme.
How possible is it, do you think, that Resolution 1973 scenario could be repeated, say, in Syria with the violence that we're seeing there?
With regard to Libya, the 1973 resolution was used as a chewing gum by NATO, so to say. I think that NATO might be deliberately demonstrating its disregard for the UN Security Council to demonstrate that NATO is equal to the United Nations nowadays and will be getting even more significant and powerful in the future. As far as Syria is concerned, I think that there will be no military operation by NATO or by any Western country, because any kind of military action against a country such as Syria will inevitably affect the security of Israel. And I think Israel is doing its best right now to stop any violence against such a big neighbor as Syria.
Military-wise, do you think, what were the chances of a rebel win if NATO hadn't intervened, if they didn't get involved?
I think that NATO basically stole the victory, but from whom? That's not significant. NATO stole the victory, that's a fact.
Could you go a little further into detail about what you mean when you say NATO stole the victory?
Well, the conclusion that we can make based on this situation is much more significant than the situation in Libya itself. NATO is turning into a global policeman nowadays, using any resolutions taken by the UN Security Council to serve its own interests, without looking at the interests of other groups, even the interests of the people they claim to be liberating in Libya. Actually, knowing NATO, I doubt very seriously that NATO was actually interested by the security and interests of ordinary Libyans when they were interfering in the conflict.
It's looking nowadays like the rebels are likely to keep control over Libya. Do you think they're capable of forming a stable government?
I don't think that is possible. First of all, because so far, the rebels were only united by a single objective, and that is to bring down Gaddafi's regime, which they hated for different reasons. Those rebels are composed by very different ethnic tribes and political groups. There are various Western interests that support the rebels, and I'm not only referring to the Western coalition, but also to some countries within the Middle East, including such a nation as Iran. So now that their enemy is down, rebels will inevitably meet some interior strikes and some interior disputes. So I think that this post-conflict resolution in Libya will be a chance for certain Western countries to secure their permanent military presence in Libya with the goal of controlling Libya's oil resources.
The U.S. and Britain are now unfreezing Gaddafi's assets to hand them over to the rebels. There is a bank, as we know, in Vienna that is reported to be considered doing the same, but holding back until it knows who exactly the money will be going to. Why were the U.S. and Britain so quick to release those assets to the rebels?
I think we should only be looking for one interest in this situation, the oil interest. They're interested in defining their favorite one to inherit the oil wealth of Libya. Libya is a country with small human resources, that is a small, relatively small population, but at the same time it is very rich in oil, in oil resources. And the 21st century has already introduced itself to us as the era of wars for resources. The resources are running short. The consumption in Western countries is not going to go down anytime soon. This means that there will be wars for new regions and new resources. And the actions of specific Western countries, as well as the entire coalition, such as NATO, will be gaining momentum and becoming even more brass in the future.
All right, well, we, of course, will continue to keep a very close eye on what's happening in Libya. For now, Dmitry Rogozin, Russia's ambassador to NATO, live on the line with us from Brussels. Thank you very much for that.
Different view of things.
Yeah, I think it's important to see that. Another fascinating, historic declaration by Palestinians, Israelis in support of Israeli social protest and anti-colonial struggle. Some 20 political parties and social movements from both sides of the Green Line issued an historic declaration in support of the social protests currently rocking Israel and their necessary linkage to the struggle against Israelis' occupation and colonial policies. Together for Putting an End to Occupation and Racism in support of the struggle of Palestinian people to attain their national rights and against national and social oppression. And man, I'll tell you, Israel's getting freaked out over this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they are freaking out. Okay, but let me hang on 1 second here. Oops, okay. This is by Ukrnet, by the way. Together for Putting It In, okay. Even in the light of the encouraging diplomatic developments in the Middle East, the wave of social protests and the awakening of the people's struggle for freedoms and the right to live in dignity, the Palestinian people still live under the yoke of Israeli occupation, despite their persistent and ongoing struggle for freedom. The international community, for its part, demonstrates its helplessness and does not lend a hand to support the Palestinian struggle for liberation and justice. The protest movements and the wind of change blowing in the Arab world have aroused excitement throughout the world amongst freedom seekers, encouraging many to adopt the model of popular struggle. These protest movements have had a deep impact on various groups in Israel, amongst both Jews and Palestinians, and made an important contribution to the rise of the popular protest movement within Israel for social justice. Want to finish that?
Moved by our aspiration to attain a just and fair peace in the region, a peace that is essential for the peoples of the region and can assist in promoting the struggle for justice and progress for everyone, we, Palestinian and Israeli people from both sides of the Green Line, emphasize the need for a joint struggle with the goal of liberating the peoples of the region from colonialism, hegemony, particularly that of Zionism, halting the occupation and Israeli military aggression, and supporting the just struggle of the Palestinian people for fulfillment of its right for self-determination in accordance with the decision of the international community. We look forward to the liberation of all regions' peoples from dictatorship, ruling tyranny, and from all forms of national, social, and economic oppression. Therefore, we, the signatories on this document, emphasize, number one, we support the Palestinian September Initiative in the United Nations, the body which carries responsibility for laying the foundation of peace internationally in order to demand full membership for Palestine in the UN and recognition of a Palestinian state in the borders of 4 June 1967 with East Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine, and to strengthen the efforts to end the occupation of the Palestinian people's lands with preservation of the right of the Palestinian people to oppose the occupation and the right of return of the refugees in accordance with the United Nations Resolution 194. In this context, we emphasize that the Palestinian Liberation Organization is the sole and legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, deriving its legitimacy both from the Palestinian people and the homeland in exile and from the recognition it received from the Arab League and the United Nations. I don't know about that. Hamas was democratically elected.
They were democratically elected, as well as the
so who wrote
Fatah
this?
Is not the PLO, so this is somebody else. And UN initiative is a legitimate step. Welcome to the cessation of the Palestinian population of Israel, and the, you know, so this is I question this And number three, we recognize the right of the Palestinian people living under occupation to make use of all the legitimate forms of resistance in accordance with international norms for removing of the occupiers from its land and for self-determination. In this context, we emphasize the importance of the joint popular struggle of Palestinians and Israelis. A popular joint struggle is one of the central guiding principles in the struggle against the occupation and the settlements, racism, colonialism, against policies of exclusion, weakening impoverishment, and racist separation within Israel.
Let's see who signed this.
Associated Palestinian Democratic Youth, Associated Progressive Students, Democratic Front for Liberation of Palestine, Democratic Front for Peace and Equality in Israel, people who are signed it, Democratic Teachers Union Palestine, Democratic Union of Professionals in Palestine, Democratic Women's Movement in Israel, Israeli Communist Party, Israel, National Campaign for Return of the Bodies of Arab and Palestinian Martyrs Captured by the Israeli Government in Palestine, Palestinian People's Party, People of Popular Campaign for the Boycott of Israeli Products of Palestine, Progressive Workers Union, Palestine,
Tarabut, Harris Abrut, Arab Jewish Movement for Social and Political Change, Israel, the Alternative Information Center, Palestine and Israel, Union of Palestinian Farmers Unions, Palestine, Union of One World for Justice, Palestine, Union of Palestine Working Women, Palestine, and Workers Union Unity Bloc, Palestine.
So these are the people that signed this statement. And
the only part that I wonder about is the PLO.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That to me is a bit questionable.
Yeah, whether or not how many people
actually support that.
Support the PLO any longer. It's questionable. So, but anyway, that's the news with the views. And let's see. We got something else here I wanted to bring up tonight. Hang on a second. Let's go back here and make sure there's no callers. Okay. Now, this one was really troubling. So typical of Obama. But he caved in on the Clean Air Act, right? And
he did?
Yep. And Obama abandons proposal to improve national air quality.
Too bad.
Yeah, it's really, it really sucks. Wait a second here for this thing to open up.
I thought that was it. That wasn't the
other. No, it's a small fire. But give it a second.
Sorry, folks. These things take time.
Sorry, people.
I'm not sure what that is.
There we
okay.
Go. Okay. I think it's almost here. Okay. Congressional Republicans have been complaining relentlessly and rather baselessly that tightening smog standards, as Obama's EPA has sought to do, would cripple the economy. Studies have indicated that those improved anti-air pollution standards would have saved tens of thousands of lives every year and prevented innumerable cases of lung disease, asthma, and respiratory illnesses. However, Obama has caved to the GOP's demands. He announced today that he was abandoning his efforts to secure cleaner, healthier air for the American public. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
He's
a corporatist.
Yeah. And the New York Times quoted him saying, "The Obama administration is abandoning its plan to immediately tighten air quality rules nationwide to reduce emissions of smog causing chemicals after an intense lobbying campaign by the industry." The White House announced that it was overruling the Environmental Protection Agency's plan to adopt a stricter standard for ground-level ozone came just hours after announcing dismal job reports and in the midst of an intensifying a political debate over the impact of federal regulations on job creation. And the unfortunate development further underscores Obama's inability to hold his ground from attacks of his political opponents, who in this case were primarily seeking to prevent very profitable industries from having to pay for pollution upgrades to their factories and power plants. He has, in essence, caved to the demands of corporations at the expense of the general health of the public. And that means that may seem a hyperbolic way of putting it, but when you distill this debate down to its essence, those are the primary concerns. Many reports show that the work required to produce and install new pollution scrubbing equipment would have created jobs, not shed them. And this is a true defeat for the administration. And more importantly, it's a blow to the welfare of the American people. And this is from...
Nobody cares about that anymore.
No. And this is from the Tree Hugger, a discovery company. It's a Tree Hugger. So, I love this in a way because it's got a Shell advertisement on top of it. Improve energy efficiency. I tell you, even the Tree Huggers, man, you know, sell out. Let's see.
They might have just placed their ad there. Energy efficiency.
Yeah, it could be. Probably AdSense or something.
They probably didn't even read what his site was about. They just...
Yeah. Probably not. It's an AdSense. That's why I stopped using it online because, I mean, it was totally absurd. They, you know, they put stuff that I'm totally dead set against, and they were advertising this, you know, anything on your site. I had to give it up because it was just... This one is more than aggravating, and might be the last one that we read tonight, but I think Lila will read this one.
This is from IPS.
International Press Service.
And it's by Stephen Leahy. U.S. awash in oil and lies, report charges. With four times as many oil rigs pumping domestic oil today than 8 years ago and declining domestic demand, the United States is awash in oil. The country's oil industry is primarily interested in who will pay the most on the global market. They call that energy security when it suits, but in reality it is oil company security through maximizing profits, says energy experts like Stephen Kretzman of Oil Change International, an NGO that researches the link between oil, gas, and coal companies and governments. The only reason U.S. citizens may be forced to endure a risky Canadian-owned oil pipeline called Keystone XL is so oil companies with billion-dollar profits can get the dirty oil from Canada's tar sands down to the Gulf of Mexico to export to Europe, Latin America, or Asia, according to a new report by Oil Change International. Released on Wednesday, Keystone XL will not lessen U.S. dependency on foreign oil, but rather transport Canadian oil to American refineries for export to overseas market, concludes the report. Little of the 700,000 to 800,000 barrels of tar sands oil pumped through the 2,400-kilometer, $7 billion Keystone XL will end up in U.S. gas tanks because the refineries on the Gulf Coast are all about expanding export markets. One huge refinery operator called Valero has been touting the potential export revenues of tar sands to investors, the report found. Because Keystone XL crosses national borders, President Barack Obama has to issue a permit declaring the pipeline serves the national interest in order to be approved. The only way Keystone XL crosses national board. Oh, I told you. The only way Keystone XL can be considered in the national interest is if you equate that with profits for the oil industry. Canada's huge tar sands deposits, located mainly in the far north of the province of Alberta, are the world's second largest reserves, but they are landlocked. It's the industry's biggest worry and also Alberta Energy Minister Ron Leeper's biggest concern. Leeper recently said that without a new pipeline, our greatest risk in Alberta is that by 2012, we will be landlocked in bitumen. Bitumen, that's coal. Bitumen is a thick, tarry oil from the tar sands that needs lots of high energy and chemical processing to be usable. One reason it's widely considered the world's dirtiest oil. The shortest route to the big Asian market is through the Rocky Mountains to Canada's west coast via the proposed Northern Gateway Pipeline. However, Canadian native people live on some of the land and are staunchly opposed, so the industry thought it would be easier to put an export pipeline right through the U.S. heartland. The oil industry would have done the Northern Gateway first, but gambled the resistance to the pipeline would be far weaker in the Midwest. They were wrong. Thousands of people, including landowners, religious leaders, have gone to D.C. in the past 2 weeks to tell President Obama to reject Keystone. Nearly 850 people have been arrested for standing on the sidewalk in front of the White House in what protesters call the largest civil disobedience in history of the U.S. climate movement. It's remarkable, a very dignified and moving protest, much like the civil rights demonstrations in the 60s. This is about the rights of the environment and future generations. It's the blossoming of a new movement. Well, I hope he's right. Only massive pipelines, other massive pipelines are planned, including ones bringing tar sands crude to New England, the Great Lakes, she said. Keystone is just the beginning. Once these are built, they will have to put something in them. Infrastructure dictates policy, she stressed. Once pipelines, refineries, or power plants are built, it is nearly impossible for governments to shut them down.
Last year, scientists writing in the journal Science concluded there is already enough fossil fuel burning capacity to raise global temperatures by 1.5 degrees centigrade by 2060. And any additional power plants, vehicles, or other fossil fuel burning equipment built from 2011 onwards puts humanity at even greater risk of catastrophic climate change. We conclude that the sources of the most threatening emissions have yet to be built.
Yet to be built.
And the scientists wrote. And the Obama administration knows this, but the powerful oil lobby can use its unlimited funds to attack Democratic officials during the next election cycle if they don't approve the pipeline. Changes to U.S. law in 210 allows corporations to spend as much as they want to on elections. There is no sector with more money than the oil industry. That scares the hell out of the Obama administration, he says. Yeah, I'm sure it does. It's never been clearer that corporations wield the real power in the United States and Canada, activist says. And this is the beginning of a very big fight for the future. That ruling was such a nightmare.
What ruling is
that? That ruling by the Supreme Court. You know, to allow corporations the right
to be treated like people.
Yeah, the right to give them access to the political process, and then on top of that, you got a guy like Romney that says, "Oh, corporations are people," you know.
Sure.
You know, so it's obvious what's happening here. You know, and if you look at Romney's plan for his total deregulation tax cuts to the industry and all that.
And wealthy people.
Yeah, you know, it's all the same bullshit. So it's like, you know, we just...
More of the same.
You know, you can't win with these guys. I mean, with any
of them. We need a separate party.
Yeah.
We need a union party.
A union party. Yeah, that would be great. That would be great. But according to Jimmy Hoffa, or James Hoffa Jr., we're Obama's army. You know, unions are Obama's army.
Well, they're going to quit.
He's full of shit. Okay, you know, as much as I agree and believe in the unions, Obama's not a union guy. Obama is a piece of shit. Okay? He'd turn the screws on the unions as fast as he would anybody else. All right? So, you know, it's for a corporate handout. So, you know, I don't know. It's just not happening, folks. But anyway, that's the news for tonight. I hope you had a good time listening. We had a good time talking.
Good night, folks.
And we hope that you got something out of it. So,
have a good evening. Yeah. Enjoy the rest of it. It's short.
And join me tomorrow night when we enter the fourth dimension. And, of course, Friday night with George Dixon. And good night.